This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, August 18th, 2015. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And coming up, why Russia wants to control the top of the world. Osama bin Laden, man of mystery, a mystery illuminated by a fascinating archive studied for the past decade. And why something as pleasant sounding as this is a throwback to another century.
I know I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain.
According to the numbers, vacations are about as out of style in America as a Glen Campbell hit from the 1960s. Americans are less comfortable than ever about taking a vacation of any size, and we'll talk about that later this hour. But today the White House announces the first ever federal regulations to cut emissions of methane, a greenhouse gas that contributes to global warming. And the emissions are sizable. These are leaked natural gas vents from the process of storing in tanks, transporting in pipelines, and drilling for natural gas. But the Environmental Protection Agency says the process is so messy, a new study estimates about 100 billion cubic feet of natural gas are lost every year. That's eight times the amount previously thought to be lost by the EPA and the equivalent of about 37 coal-fired power plants. Lee Patterson, a reporter for Inside Energy, joins us and says the politics of methane are much quieter but just as controversial as the congressional battles over oil, wind, and solar power.
The politics of methane really get at kind of President Obama's broader climate agenda. Interestingly enough, in states like Wyoming and Colorado, and Wyoming especially, is usually opposed to EPA regulations. But by and large, some oil and gas states are kind of already moving in the direction of regulating methane emissions. And in fact, Colorado recently passed legislation to limit those sorts of emissions. And the EPA might, in fact, have modeled their federal regulations on what Colorado was actually doing. So I wouldn't say that methane is as much of a political football as the Clean Power Plan, for example. But at this point, really, any sort of environmental regulations coming from the EPA, coming from the president, are seen as sort of, you know, an avalanche. It's one thing after another at this point. So broadly speaking, these new regulations are controversial in terms of the specifics of what they're regulating, less controversial.
Well, they're making their way through the political system much more quietly than the clean energy plan that was announced last week. And if you do the math, these have the possibility, in any case, the potential of having a huge effect on the environment. Gone are the days when we see methane, you know, vents just burning forever without any concern about what's being released into the environment. I mean, when you add it up, the amount of emissions from pipelines, from fracking, from drilling is a huge amount of methane, and that's a greenhouse gas. What is the level of emissions in the oil and gas industry, as far as we can tell?
Well, I think the days of venting are not quite in the rearview mirror yet, but you know, as you said, methane is a potent greenhouse gas. According to the EPA, it's more than 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So this is a big deal. But methane is also a major component of natural gas, and we are doing quite a bit of drilling for natural gas recently. During oil and gas development, methane can be emitted or even leaked accidentally. So the EPA's new regulations aim to limit the amount of methane released during oil and gas development by around 40-45% over the next decade from 2012 levels. But the new regulations are expected to apply only to new and modified equipment, not to existing equipment. And really, that's one of the critiques from environmental groups.
What do we make of this permit from the Department of Interior this week for Shell to drill in the Arctic off the Alaskan coast?
Well, you know, it of course complicates things. And the president's climate agenda, I think one of his kind of signature moves is towing the line between development and also, you know, slowing the effects of climate change. So it's really, it's a very mixed message. To me, it seems as though he's trying to both slow the effects of climate change, but also in some ways encourage oil and gas development. So it's complicated. I mean, you know, energy development is a big economic driver in this country. So he really has to toe the line.
Lee Patterson is a reporter for Inside Energy.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And LegalZoom, dedicated to providing legal help to all Americans through online services, personal customer support, and legal advice through independent attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Here's something to think about. Vladimir Putin as Santa Claus?
Искренне рад приветствовать участников и гостей третьего международного форума Арктика территория диалога.
In 2013, at an international Arctic forum, there's the Russian president who seems to present himself as a custodian or caretaker of the North Pole, if not its full-time Christmas resident. Global warming may have complicated the mythology for Santa Claus, but it has made Russian access to a coveted shipping route, the Northeastern Passage, connecting Europe to China, a reality. Russia submitted its very first bid for the Arctic seashelf back in 2002 to a United Nations committee. It was rejected for lack of evidence. But now the Russians have returned, armed with new geological data, to make an even bigger claim of sovereign territory off their northern coastline. Scott Borgerson is co-founder of Arctic Circle, a nonprofit striving to increase international coordination in the region, and he says global warming has been very good for Russian interests.
The Arctic sea ice is melting really at a radical pace. In fact, in just the past three decades, the sea ice has lost half its area and three-quarters of its total volume.
What evidence do we have that the Russians are really making a play for this suddenly open sea?
Well, they're doing lots of things that involve investing in infrastructure such as new icebreakers, government bureaucracy trying to open the seaway over the Northeast Passage. But they're also following procedures under the UN Convention on Law of the Sea, of which they're a member and the United States is not, to claim additional territory in the Arctic, which would give them potentially vast new tracts of ocean space. In fact, 1.2 million square kilometers of additional seabed in the Arctic Ocean.
Now, how do you claim ocean space? You can't just plant a flag.
You cannot, although they have done that in the past. That was really just for publicity and less for international law. So this is actually a technical process that's very clearly spelled out in something called the 1982 UN Convention on Law of the Sea that not just Russia, but most countries in the world, in fact, nearly all countries in the world and all the Arctic coastal states, with the exception of the United States, to actually its embarrassment and hurting its national interest in the Arctic, all belong to this treaty. And this treaty has very clear guidelines under something called Article 76 that spell out the technical processes for claiming additional seafloor in the not just the Arctic Ocean, all oceans, if a coastal state can prove that it's connected to its landmass.
And in this particular case, the Russians would get access to the sea lane itself, which they can defend with their naval ships, but also mining rights to what's on the bottom of the ocean?
So yes and no. So they already have access to the sea lanes above Eurasia. That's just part of what it gets under the normal provisions of the treaty. It's the additional space beyond that that comes from proving, in this case, two submarine mountain ridges. Russian scientists are making the case with bathymetric data and submarine geology that these are actually extensions of Eurasia. Whereas others say, well, maybe they're just oceanic crust from tectonic plates coming together. But of course, Canada and Denmark, by virtue of Greenland, have made arguments actually that these are submarine ridges connected to their land masses. Therefore, they should be the ones entitled to the extra space.
Who can adjudicate this? Geologists? Politicians? It seems like, I mean, the world is just the world, you know?
So you're right on both of those. It's actually first a 21-member technical body called the Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf. It's part of the United Nations. They review the technical submission by Russia. And what they will determine, as they have for other countries like Norway or in other parts of the world like Australia, whether or not the Russian submission meets the technical guidelines. And if it does, they'll simply say it's not part of the international seabed. But then it's up to Russia to work out with its neighbors exactly where to draw the line on the map.
All right, Scott. So let's say Russia wins everything. They win in every tribunal. They manage to grab as much sea lane as they want. What advantages does this give them in terms of commerce, in terms of strategic ability to control the Arctic, that sort of thing?
So this particular claim, it gives them rights to additional resources in the seabed, minerals, oil, natural gas, and all the types of things that in a very growing and exciting business, countries and businesses are looking to develop. The reality, however, is that this seafloor that they're claiming is quite far from land. It's still covered by ice much of the time. It's a very remote and hazardous place. And Shell is drilling for oil for the first time this summer off of Alaska. That's very close to shore and is very expensive and difficult to do. So we're talking about parts of the ocean near the North Pole and the North Pole itself, which are so remote and inhospitable still. There's no immediate near-term economic implication, but over the long term, there's certainly potential value there. And I think symbolically, especially for the North Pole, this conceivably could be very important.
Taking oil and gas out of it, I remember there was discussion that on the seabed in the Arctic, there are all these nodules of rare earth elements that could be of extraordinary strategic importance.
Absolutely. Deep seabed mining is a growing industry, and we actually know more about the surface of the moon than we do about the deep oceans. And so the oceans are really a frontier, not just for minerals, but for new medicines, from the bioprospecting from deep beneath the ocean seafloor, from all sorts of natural resources that really scientists are only beginning to understand the great and just awesome potential our oceans can deliver.
So you're trying to help us understand the Arctic maybe a little better than we understand the moon, right?
Well, I do my part. I think Americans in Lower 48 forget just how big and close the Arctic is. So Texans are fond of saying everything's bigger in Texas, but that's actually not true. Alaska is 2.5 times the size of Texas. The Arctic's massive, and it's vast in its natural resources. And climate change is happening in the Arctic faster than anywhere else. This is not a sort of a scientific sort of fiction story about what might happen tomorrow. It's happening today with profound political but also economic implications for all of us here in the Lower 48.
Scott Borgerson is co-founder of Arctic Circle, a nonprofit striving to increase international coordination and knowledge about the Arctic. Thanks so much, Scott.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
The name Osama bin Laden, recognizable everywhere and known by every American schoolchild, is the ultimate boogeyman. But as a military insurgent and leader of Al-Qaeda, the base, the organization he named, bin Laden is much more mysterious. In October of 2004, he sent this message to seemingly try and influence the U.S. presidential election.
People of America, I shall be speaking to you on important topics which concern you, so lend me your ears.
Bin Laden seemed to endorse George W. Bush in the U.S. election, a tactic seen as favoring John Kerry. But that was only a guess, and he reiterated that he directed the attackers on September 11th. But from behind the shadows, another picture emerges of bin Laden in a dusty box of cassettes, documents, and videotapes, more than 1,500 cassette tapes belonging to bin Laden, left behind in his former home in Kandahar, Afghanistan, after the 9/11 attacks. The BBC's security correspondent Gordon Carrera connected with an American Arabic scholar who's been studying this archive for a decade. Carrera says the material is a unique historical treasure.
So these tapes were found in Kandahar, Afghanistan, just after 9/11. They were abandoned in a ransacked house. Eventually, they were first bought by a CNN producer who was thought they might actually be destroyed, and they were just up for sale. But eventually, they found their way first to the Afghan Media Project at Williams College in Massachusetts. And then Professor Flagg Miller from the University of California, Davis, was the one who spent 10 years analyzing these tapes, listening to them. He's an Arabist who understands the language and worked through them to see what we could learn about Osama bin Laden and the emergence of Al-Qaeda.
Before we listen to some tape, what was Miller's impression of bin Laden sort of in total here, having spent so much time, a decade, going through all this material?
Well, I think what's fascinating about this is it challenges some of our assumptions about Osama bin Laden. I mean, one of them is that it was all about America during the 1990s as the main enemy. I mean, what's clear from the tapes is that that only evolved much later and towards the final years of the 1990s. Before then, if you listen to these tapes, as Flag Miller has done, you don't actually hear relatively few references to America. It's much more about corruption in Muslim countries and some of the other enemies that are out there, people like kind of communists and secularists and others.
And dictators like Saddam Hussein. He's as much of an enemy of Saddam Hussein as George W. Bush.
Because he's seen as a kind of secular dictator who's oppressing religion. And so you see that evolution. Then you see Osama bin Laden break with the Saudi state and the Saudi royal family and become a critic of those of what he says are corrupt regimes there. And then later in the 1990s, particularly, you start to see America and the West emerge as enemies. So you do see this evolution in the range of enemies that he portrays through that period of the 1990s.
Well, here, this tape takes us back to the days of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, perhaps before al-Qaeda even existed, when bin Laden was just one of the mujahideen fighting the Soviet Union.
It's a live audio recording of commanders in Afghanistan speaking in Arabic, include bin Laden. And they're operating from what was known as the Lion's Den, which was the nickname for bin Laden's small camp in Afghanistan. And they're taking on Spetsnaz Soviet commandos, and they're planning a bombing of a warehouse.
Now, that's Flag Miller himself, the professor, speaking to you about a recording of an actual battle in progress.
Well, that's right. And what's extraordinary about this is the kind of radio communication being recorded with Osama bin Laden talking to some of the other people involved in this operation. What's fascinating, of course, is the fact that they made the recording and then they kept the recording within this archive, which I think also suggests the extent to which bin Laden was trying to forge this image, this myth of this great warrior who'd taken on the Soviets, when in fact, of course, he and his groups had not been necessarily central to that. They'd been part of that struggle. But keeping tapes, making tapes, was part of building the myth.
And in this next piece of tape here, you can feel the mythology growing, this idea that we've bagged one superpower and we're looking for different and newer enemies and trying to get other people to join our cause. Listen.
This is one of those Islamic anthem tapes. This is stuff that, you know, for many audiences is the way into jihad, and that is through the heart. It's far more emotional than rational kind of draw.
And in this case, we have a pitch for jihadists that doesn't include the violence and the beheadings and all the things that we've come to know as the sort of pitch videos for jihad. This is a very early message here.
That's right. And this is quite typical of the propaganda of the time. Propaganda not directed, as the first clip you played from 2004, at Western audiences, but at other Muslims to try to draw them into this notion of the struggle and of al-Qaeda and to try and present it in a certain way. And that's typical of a lot of material in the collection. And it's kind of interesting contrasting that now with the kind of propaganda you see from Syria and Iraq and from ISIS, ISIL, that group. But at that time that bin Laden was operating, it was much more about songs and cassettes as the way of trying to spread the message and to try and draw people into their cause of violence.
Now, here is a very chilling tape because, and you'll have to set this into context, this is when the crystallization of the mission of al-Qaeda to attack the United States and to train people to actually be attackers of the West. And listen to this.
New Intercom 4, Unit 10. A job in Dallas.
Good morning. May I help you? Is it too late to apply for the computer programmer position? No, you can still apply. Let's see. The applications were right here a minute ago. Oh, here they are.
Now, what is this?
there's a few oddities and kind of very almost jarring tapes within this collection. I think this is certainly one of them. This is basically a learning English tape. It's training people to be able to go, in this case, and go get a job in the United States. And the last tape is one of the last ones in the collection is perhaps the most chilling, because it's the wedding of a bodyguard just before 9/11, in which Osama bin Laden appears at the end of the tape and gives a message in which he suggests that something big is about to happen, and all the signs are that he may well there have been talking about the 9/11 attacks.
Gordon Carrera, BBC security correspondent, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Put the products in the box and you get to keep your job. Miss the time goal and you get to play unemployment. You know, if it seems like getting a promotion is more like getting to the second quest level 9 in the Legend of Zelda video game, you're not crazy. Data drives employee advancement more than ever today. And today there is more data than ever before. Workers of the world, welcome to Stardate 2015 in the spreadsheet century. Case in point, Amazon. There's been a lot of reaction to a New York Times investigation into the intensive data-driven culture at Amazon. The article was referenced by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos over the weekend, who said he didn't recognize the company the New York Times portrayed. Quote, "Even if it's rare or isolated, our tolerance for any such lack of empathy needs to be zero," he wrote. Here's a clip from a rare look inside Amazon, part of a BBC documentary from a few years ago. Here's an employee who quit after experiencing, with a hidden camera, exhausting, demeaning conditions.
Like a lot of people, I'm used to Amazon as a customer, and it's convenient and bright. So I sort of thought if I was going to go and work for the company, it would sort of be a happy, positive place, but it seems to be the complete opposite, to be quite honest.
In its report, which confirmed a lot of what the BBC reported and added new details, the New York Times described a workplace where the supervisor emailing continues past midnight, where colleagues are encouraged to report on each other's shortcomings to their bosses, and where workers who suffered miscarriages or took time to tend to dying parents said they were told to make sure their focus stayed on their job. Is this the wave of the present in the high-tech workplace? Workers are data, and bad data needs to be deleted like error messages? Or do workers need to change their concepts of modern work altogether? Joel Slattis is president of Timesheets.com, which makes clock-in software used by 1,400 small companies, joins me. And Andrew McAfee is associate director at the Initiative on the Digital Economy at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
Now, Joel, you've got the scary machines, right, which allow you to tell exactly what I'm doing second to second, right?
Well, we don't actually track you on a second-to-second basis. We're more like a traditional time clock. We're just online in the cloud. So we would track when someone clocks in or when they clock out. Or if you were recording time for billable purposes, you would say, well, I worked 5 hours on this job or something like that. But it's not so big brothery that it's tracking you just along the way every day, all the time.
All right. Well, I'll be the judge of that, Joel. But a time clock in the cloud, that's very ingenious. I love that. We'll talk about it more in just a moment. Andrew, let's just stipulate for a moment in theory that, you know, Amazon is the worst place in the world. It's also the case that American workers and workers around the world need a cultural shift to understand that this is the way things are going to be done in the future. And both workers and companies have to make places, you know, workable for humans, both in terms of pleasant job conditions as well as allowing this information to be collected. Right, Andrew?
Yeah, I believe that. And when new technologies come along, they do change that agreement, that contract, the informal one between workers and companies.
All right. So how do you make evaluation of workers not so big brothery, Joel, in your design of equipment?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't think that big brothery is really on the minds of most people these days. Everybody expects to be clocking in or out of work. Everyone expects to be writing down their time if they're doing billable stuff. It doesn't come up as much as you might think it does. And actually, the employee experience is a good experience when they're using our service, a service like ours, like timesheets.com, because they have more access to data than they used to have. An employee can log in, for instance, and see exactly how much accrued sick and vacation time they have. They can make requests whenever they want. So they have access to data now that they didn't used to have. And the whole big brother aspect really isn't as overbearing, I think, as some people might think it is using a product like that.
Andrew McAfee, do employees like to be able to go online and see a pie chart of their performance and attempt to improve it? Or is that information they don't want to look at?
It depends critically on how that information is presented to them. But in general, most of us like to know how we're doing, and we'd like to be able to do better at it. A lot of us are monitoring different parts of our daily lives. We're trying to become healthier. And if that information is presented correctly, it does become kind of a game where you try to better yourself over time.
Joel, how do you, use the data and the machines that you develop to get the employee more involved in the actual data collection?
It's actually interesting that you say that, that you bring that topic up. We're in the middle of working on a new product. The idea was originally to come up with sort of like a Facebook-style wall that an employee could write on, something of a productivity tool that would give employees the ability to sort of crow a little bit about their accomplishments and what they're doing at work. And so we're working on, sort of massaging that to give employees a way to put things up on the company wall to say, yeah, I did this today, or I was able to accomplish this. And the idea is that when an employee writes down what they did or a milestone or an accomplishment and other employees see it, they themselves would be encouraged to do the same thing.
All right. Let's alternatively stipulate for the moment that the New York Times profile of Amazon focused only on the whining employees who complain about everything all the time and that Amazon is actually a great place to work. Andrew McAfee, where do companies run the risk of going wrong with these strategies? If workers are relatively content, can you push it over the limit and really turn things around?
Yeah, if it does become a privacy violation and it really does start to feel like a big brother or somebody watching me every second, not trusting me, and me not getting anything back from that, those are both unproductive ways to head with this new opportunity to gather data.
Andrew McAfee, Associate Director of the Initiative on the Digital Economy at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Joel Slattis is President of Timesheets.com, which makes clock-in software used by 1,400 small companies. Joel and Andrew, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
If you have a counter story or would like to weigh in and say something maybe a little different than these two fellows did about Amazon or data collection at your workplace, call us at 877-8MYTAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org.
Support for PRI's The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
It's going to be a lot of golfing for President Obama while he's on vacation in Martha's Vineyard this week. He also took a stack of books with him to read, and the White House has this week given us the playlist in chief.
In the palm of my two hands, hold each other. Everything. Can I just have one moment dance with you, my love?
From Miles Davis to Van Morrison to Mary J. Blige. Some might say his playlist is pretty safe. No explicit lyrics. Doesn't take too many risks. But maybe that's a discussion for the Obama post-presidency. It's good the president takes a vacation, though, right? Leaders should lead the rest of us by example. Michael Jordan, for instance, promising to take a break after winning the 1991 NBA Finals.
Michael Jordan and the Bulls, you just won your first NBA championship. What are you going to do next?
We're going to Disney World!
Yeah!
Now, did he really go to Disney World or did he just take some promotional fee? Well, it turns out that only half of Americans are actually taking those trips and going to places like Disney World. And it's been a steady decline since 1991. New research suggests that 56% of Americans haven't taken any vacation at all in the last 12 months. And that's 10 million more people than the year before. The U.S. is, after all, the only so-called industrialized nation that doesn't mandate time off. Americans are taking the least amount of vacation in nearly four decades. That's in the numbers, folks. Kathleen Gerson is a sociology professor at NYU who specializes in issues related to work, family, and gender equality. Kathleen, it's good that President Obama takes a vacation and shows that sort of leadership. Well, how come we're not taking the cue from him?
Good question. Were we all presidents? Although I will also say it's probably hard for him to take a vacation as well in this country. Americans have very low expectations about vacation time compared to the rest of the world. Europeans routinely take 4 to 6 weeks. It's mandated. It's expected. No one has to apologize for it. In fact, they probably have to apologize if they don't take it. But there's been a convergence of forces in the U.S., both in terms of employer pressure, employee fear and concerns about losing their jobs or not moving ahead, and just this general notion of the work ethic that has made it very difficult for Americans to start to think systematically and humanistically about how important taking time off is for regenerating our batteries, being productive workers, being good family members, being involved citizens, all those other aspects of life that not only make us a stronger country, but actually make us better, more productive workers.
You know, the media is complicit in this as well. And if we go back to the president, you said it was hard for him to take a vacation. Part of the reason it's hard is that if he's on the golf course and some international crisis erupts, the first thing that happens is, oh, he's on the golf course. He's not paying attention to the affairs of the world. That's the kind of media reporting that you would not see in Europe and in places where vacation is more expected.
Absolutely. That is so true. And it's not only based on a false premise. In fact, someone's best thinking can be done on a golf course or in a swimming pool or reading a book or in the shower. And in fact, when we assume that if one is not physically at work, concentrating directly on that, that somehow we're not being productive, that we're not doing the important work we need to do.
Well, vacation shaming certainly has an impact on people's decisions of how much vacation they're going to take. There's also the question of, economically speaking, they can't afford to take a vacation. Do you think people are catching up from the financial downturn, that they want to constantly try to stay ahead and are in a state of fear about taking too much vacation?
Well, in some sense, it would actually be good news if this were simply a matter of recovering from a temporary downturn. But unfortunately, we've seen these trends happening for decades now, and they seem to be intensifying. The downturn certainly didn't help. I'm sure it did contribute to it. But underneath the short-term economic ups and downs, what we have is a growing sense of concern and fear, not simply about moving ahead, but keeping one's job, and that notion that if you can't, it's not simply a matter of how hard are you working. It's being able to prove how hard you're working. So it really is time, I think, for Americans to rethink this notion of work and life. We see this in surveys everywhere. If you ask workers and even managers what their ideal would be, they all espouse a balanced notion that being a good worker also means having a full and integrated life. Unfortunately, when you ask them what they do or what they think their options are, for almost everyone says, this is not something that I can achieve. In a better world, this would be my goal. But if I can achieve this, then my priority has to be able to keep my job, to prove that I'm a good worker.
Now, Kathleen, can I ask you a personal question?
Of course.
You're a professor of sociology at NYU, right?
Yes.
Do you have tenure?
I do.
And you still have this problem? Oh, my God.
Exactly. In fact, people look at me and say, and don't quite understand it. And part of it is that the process that we have of building careers takes its toll over time, so that by the time that you may achieve a measure of security, if you're lucky to do so in this society, and that's getting harder and harder, you've internalized these pressures, these expectations. I don't want to go too far because I personally, I love my work, but I'm always amazed when I do, when I'm forced, usually by events beyond my control. For example, I recently took a brief vacation to attend and oversee my daughter's wedding. And I have to admit, it was hard to pull back from work. But once I was there, I realized how important it is for all of us to do that.
Well, I just have to say, I prescribe for you, Kathleen Gerson, a year's sabbatical in Tuscany with at least a month of time off there.
Well, thank you very much, and I will tell my employer that right away. But I promise you this, if I do spend that year, I'll probably be sitting at my desk reading, writing, doing research.
Kathleen Gerson is a professor of sociology at NYU. Have a great summer, Kathleen.
Thank you so much, and you too.
And here's something to take with you today, Strange Allies Who Changed American History. Today marks 95 years since the ratification of the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote, thanks in part to Harry Byrne, a 24-year-old member of the Tennessee House of Representatives who switched his vote after receiving a letter from his mom urging him to be a good boy and support women's right to vote. But just 8 months before, the 18th Amendment was passed, prohibiting the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors. The two amendments represent a giant wave of social change 7 decades in the making. Women broadly supported control of drunkenness to prevent poverty, eliminate domestic violence, stabilize households by helping men to hold on to their jobs. Women saw getting the vote as key to making these and other social changes, including improving working conditions for women. The overlap of the suffrage movement and the temperance movement is one of the most curious alignments in U.S. history. Women got the vote, which led directly to modern feminism. Prohibition led to little more than a wave of organized crime and to the 21st Amendment, the repeal of prohibition. Brendan on Facebook writes, "And today we celebrate women's right to vote by showing up to vote 40% of the time." Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, featuring custom learning consultations to help each member of the household learn skills like drumming, duct tape dressmaking, and data visualization. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.